Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, November 18th, 2025, we are delighted to host this discussion on the recent attempts to address federal overcriminalization. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have John Malcolm, Shanna O'Toole, and Professor Kenneth Simmons as our speakers, and Mark Levin as our moderator. Mr. Levin is Chief Policy Counsel for the Council on Criminal Justice and Senior Advisor for Right on Crime. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature on Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mr. Levin, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks so much. I'm really excited about the discussion we have today on overcriminalization. And it's been several months since the executive order on that subject and a congressional hearing on a couple of bills pending in Congress. And we'll have a chance to discuss both in this session. I want to start before I provide a brief, more fulsome summary of what we're going to discuss and preview. I wanted to first introduce the three terrific panelists we have with us today. First, Professor Simmons, Kenneth Simmons, a true leading scholar in this field, particularly on the overlap of civil and criminal law. And he's co-director of the Center for Legal Philosophy, as well as a professor at the UC Irvine School of Law. He was the chief reporter of the American Law Institute's Restatement Third of Torts. He also clerked for former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Oh, it was Thurgood Marshall, actually. You don't look particularly old, so it's I almost caught myself there and said that couldn't have been, but it was. And we published a really influential scholarship on a whole range of topics, including mens rea and bias crimes, corrective justice, egalitarian norms, and strict criminal liability. Another terrific panelist we have with us today, John Malcolm, is vice president of the Institute for Constitutional Government and head of the Meese Center for Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Before joining Heritage, he was general counsel at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, as well as a distinguished practitioner residence at Pepperdine Law School. He also served executive vice president of the Motion Picture Association of America and was deputy assistant attorney general in the DOJ Criminal Justice Division from 2001 to 2004. And then finally, we have with us Shanna O'Toole, who's founder and president of the Due Process Institute and has years of work as a criminal defense attorney, as well as in legal reform advocacy. She's really focused on the erosion of due process rights and trying to create a more balanced system. She's been a leader on a host of issues, including overcriminalization, indigent defense, and the Due Process Institute has really, I think, established itself as a leading voice, nonpartisan, that is listened to on both sides of the aisle in Washington when it comes to these types of issues. So with that, let me just say a couple words about the topic that we're discussing here today. And I think the reason it's so important is that it's the traditional definition of a crime was actus reus and mens rea. And these are, you know, Latin words that go back centuries, but a bad act plus a guilty mind. And of course, we all know there's exceptions like negligent homicide because it's such a serious harm to someone that we want to still punish it. But even then, of course, negligent homicide carries a much lower penalty than murder because we recognize the importance of a guilty mind of mens rea. And so, of course, amid a time of great partisanship. One of the notable things about the congressional hearing that occurred in May on the House Judiciary Committee on this topic was that all the witnesses called by both the Republican and the Democratic sides essentially said the same thing and agreed that we have too many crimes. They're too vague. They're too overly broad, overlapping, and that we really need to address this issue of mens rea. And of course, they all essentially agreed that one of the reasons it's important to have clear, concise criminal laws is to put people on notice about what's against law, particularly what's a crime and what could get you locked up. Number one, we hope that therefore people will comply. But if they don't, they at least knew about this and chose to violate the law. And that then really justifies the sanction. Now, I think that one of the things we will address today is not just the issue of mens rea, but the issue of excessive numbers of crimes. And in particular, there's the Count the Crimes Act, which was one of the proposals discussed at that hearing that would mandate the Department of Justice produce a comprehensive inventory of all federal criminal statutes, including regulatory offenses. Dick Thornburg once said there's hundreds of thousands of regulatory crimes, that, i.e. those created by administrative agencies, not passed by Congress. Now, perhaps there's blanket provisions and laws which say an agency can designate a violation of its rules as a criminal offense. So Congress is culpable for perhaps overly broad provisions like that. But this Count the Crimes Act also says they need to include the elements and enforcement data to create a baseline for knowing what's going on in terms of all these offenses, how often they're used, if at all. And then there's also the Mens Rea Reform Act, which was discussed at the hearing, that proposes inserting a clear, knowing, or equivalent mental state requirement into any federal offense lacking mens rea. Now, the executive order that we'll also be discussing sets out steps for agency typically list all regulatory offenses that carry criminal penalties on their website, state what the mens rea is, if any, and it seeks to discourage the use of strict criminal liability. Even though there's a lot of agreement in this, I also hope that this discussion will shed some light on, a few different areas of potential disagreement. Are we going too far? Are we going to, open the floodgates for white collar crime? Or do some of these things not go far enough? For example, if we're just listing the crimes but not actually getting rid of any of the ones that are excessive. And then secondly, where is the intersection of white collar crime versus traditional crime? And do we need to make sure we're consistent? You're reminded of the Florida drug law case where basically it said strict criminal liability for drugs. And there was a case where somebody rented a car at Hertz and didn't realize there were drugs where the spare tire was supposed to be. And for people that may be interested in this solely from a white collar perspective, are they willing to acknowledge there might be people that get off for traditional crimes if we're going to be consistent about mens rea? And then finally, how do we deal with the intersection with civil law? And do we need to say, okay, if we're going to roll back the use of crime to go after things like environmental and financial regulation, roll back the use of criminal law, do we have to acknowledge that there's a role for civil law? And how does that intersect with the movement, for example, for tort reform around the country? So with that, I want to invite our panelists to each make some opening comments. And John, I'll start with you, if that's all right. And then we will have time for some Q&A after that. Thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in today.
Oh, thank you, Mark. And it's a pleasure to join everybody today. So, federal overcriminalization has been a problem for a very, very long time, and not much has been done to address it. The problem manifests itself in many, many ways. I'd like to mention four of them during my introductory remarks. So first, as Mark just alluded to, there are so many federal criminal laws that nobody knows for sure how many there are, what they are, and where they are. So in 2022, the Heritage Foundation partnered with the Mercatus Center to conduct a rigorous study in which we estimated that in 2019, there were 1,510 federal statutes in the U.S. Code that contain 5,199 federal crimes. And of course, there are far more, hundreds of thousands more criminal violations that are set forth in the Code of Federal Regulations. And these myriad of federal crimes really become a trap for the unwary. Now, everybody knows the phrase, which dates back to Aristotle, that ignorance of the law is no excuse. And that rule, of course, makes eminent sense when laws prohibit things that are morally wrong, like murder, battery, fraud, theft, kidnapping, arson, the whole list of what we refer to as malum in se offenses. But the same can't be said for malum prohibitum crimes, that is, things that have been called crimes simply because they are prohibited. So, for example, did you know that it is a federal crime to sell Swiss cheese without any holes in it? Who knew? Think that's a one-off? Think again. It is a crime to submit a design to the federal duck stamp contest if your design does not primarily feature, quote, eligible waterfowl. It's also a crime to sell a toy marble across state lines unless it contains the warning, this is a toy marble. A few years ago, a lawyer named Mike Chase wrote a book called How to Become a Federal Criminal, in which he highlighted some of the most absurd crimes that are sprinkled throughout the U.S. Code and the Code of Federal Regulations. Suffice it to say that the number of federal crimes in federal law is enormous and growing, and it applies to many, many things that no reasonable person would think of as crimes. Criminal laws are supposed to be reserved for the most opprobrious conduct. When criminal laws, they go after a behavior that is trivial and that nobody would recognize as being opprobrious, that diminishes respect for the rule of law. James Madison once said, and I quote, "It will be of little avail to the people that laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read or so incoherent that they cannot be understood." Precisely so. Second, many of these crimes, as Mark just said, lack adequate or in some cases any mens rea requirements. As I said on many occasions, absent extraordinary circumstances, people who do something that results in harm, but who do not act with an intent to harm or who do not know that there is a substantial risk that harm will result, should be dealt with through the civil justice system, tort law, or through the administrative system. They should not be criminally prosecuted. Criminal prosecution should be reserved for those who do something that is widely recognized as being morally blameworthy with some knowledge of what they're doing. In his magisterial book, The Common Law, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. once put it this way, "Even a dog distinguishes between being stumbled over and being kicked." While it's unclear how often people are being prosecuted for crimes that lack a mens rea requirement, the mere knowledge that such laws exist can have a chilling effect on people who are just trying to go about their everyday lives and small business owners who are just trying to get by and make an honest living. And it also provides tremendous leverage to the government to extract large civil penalties by threatening to initiate a criminal prosecution unless someone pays up. Lavrenty Beria, the head of Joseph Stalin's secret police, purportedly said, "Show me the man and I'll show you the crime." Well, in a world in which virtually any activity that results in some harm, and even some that doesn't result in harm, can be twisted to fit within the parameters of some obscure criminal regulation, nobody is safe. And it also creates a situation in which vague criminal laws can be employed by zealous prosecutors to go against their political enemies and not be used or invoked against their political allies. Now, President Trump, very much to his credit, has taken some action to try to address this problem. On May the 9th, he issued Executive Order 14294, which is titled Fighting Overcriminalization in Federal Regulations, in which he referred to the status quo as absurd and unjust. He also declared that it's U.S. policy that criminal enforcement of criminal regulatory offenses is disfavored and strict liability offenses are generally disfavored. He directed the heads of every agency to provide the Office of Management and Budget with a list of all criminal regulatory offenses that are enforceable either by that agency or the Department of Justice, along with the potential penalty and the applicable mens rea standard. He also ordered each agency had this report supposed to be provided within a year. He also then directed each agency head to publicly post that report on its website. He added that criminal enforcement of any criminal regulatory offense that is not identified in that report is strongly discouraged. He directed that all futures notice of proposed rulemaking and final rules, anyone that has a criminal consequence should explain what the mens rea standard is for each element of that offense. And that any proposed final rule or notice of proposed rulemaking that contains a strict liability offense has to be submitted to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs for review. He directed every agency head to also look at their implementing statutory authority to see whether there is authority to adopt a default mens rea standard that would apply unless a specific regulation provides otherwise. And he also directed each agency to submit a plan to OMB to adopt that default mens rea standard or to give a justification for deviating from that. The third reason that I want to discuss is that there are so many, there are just tons of duplicative federal crimes. So that enables prosecutors to stack potential penalties and provides astonishing leverage to prosecutors in these cases. And finally, there are many federal crimes, particularly firearms offenses and narcotics offenses, that duplicate state offenses. They provide federal authorities with concurrent jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Now, that dilutes accountability. People are not sure who's supposed to be in charge of enforcing those laws. There are resource constraints that go along with those decisions. I have to say that these days, this may not be such a bad thing, particularly, at least from my perspective, in jurisdictions that are overseen by so-called progressive prosecutors who are refusing to zealously enforce a lot of these laws, leaving it to federal authorities to do what is necessary in order to protect public safety. Shouldn't be that way, but it is. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Shanna.
All right. Thank you, John. I agree that the term overcriminalization is a multi-pronged concept. And stands for sort of a number of ills that are currently facing our federal criminal law system. It does refer to the incessant creation of overly broad and poorly defined federal crimes and refers to an existence of the duplicative criminal statutes that just continuously increase exposure to prosecution, as John pointed out. For me, it is also the federalization of certain crimes that used to be and frankly should still be prosecuted at the state level, not only the firearm offenses that John mentions, but also minor drug offenses. But it is the creation of crimes for which the level of mens rea or culpable intent is vague or unclear as to some or perhaps all of the offense. But finally, for me, the term overcriminalization also includes the unduly harsh sentencing policies that place a premium on lengthy imprisonment and that use incarceration as sort of the first and only choice of penalty when less costly or fairer alternatives would be just as effective as a deterrent and frankly more productive for society. In response to the concerns I've been raising about overcriminalization throughout my career, I often hear people say, don't worry, prosecutors will exercise their discretion wisely, even if the laws are too broad, even if they're too vague, too numerous, or inadequate intent requirements. But pish posh, we can count on them to use these laws wisely. They'll take these tools and make good use of them. Unfortunately, each of the panelists today probably have their own set of particular favorite examples to the contrary. I'm just going to point out two very quickly. Each of these happens to fall under the rubric of environmental crimes. And I've done this on purpose because I'm going to self-disclose to this audience that I personally lean more towards progressive politics. And I consider myself a stalwart defender of the environment. And so I've purposely picked two environmental prosecutions because I think they're ludicrous. And I want to point out that while, of course, we need environmental laws on the books, these can be overused because of the factors of overcriminalization. So first example, Skylar Capo was an 11-year-old who loved animals. She spotted an injured woodpecker. It was about to be eaten by the cat that had pulled it out of the tree with the snails. She asked her mom if she could nurse the bird back to health. Her mom agreed. And in order to avoid leaving the dying bird at home, the girl carried the bird in a cute little box to a local home improvement store while her mom ran errands. While in the store, an undercover U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services agent stopped young Skylar, explained that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act protects woodpeckers, that transporting the bird is actually a violation of federal law. And if that were the end of this story, we'd all probably feel like the right thing had been done. Instead, 2 weeks later, that same agent showed up at the girl's home, delivered an over $500 criminal fine, and informed the family that the girl's mom was facing up to 1 year in prison. It was only after this story made national headlines that the agency dropped its criminal investigation against the family. There's also the example of Nancy Black, a licensed marine biologist and whale researcher. One day, she's in her research boat. Killer whales attack a pod of gray whales and succeed in killing one of the calves. Portions of the calf's body float to the surface. The killer whales start to feed on it. Seizing this opportunity to film their behavior, Miss Black threaded ropes through some pieces of the meat to keep them in place and then lowered a camera underwater. For doing this, she faced up to 20 years in prison and $500,000 in criminal fines after a federal grand jury indicted her. Little about these charges, to my mind, makes common sense. The federal law in question is the 1972 Marine Mammals Protection Act. Its intention is to save dolphins, seals, and whales from being killed and harassed by humans. Good intention. The law bans feeding these animals on the theory that doing so might compromise their ability to forage naturally in the future. In this case, Miss Black was accused of unlawfully feeding the killer whales, despite the fact that all she was doing was merely observing, for legitimate scientific purposes, a natural feeding that was already in progress. Like so many people who have faced unfair prosecutions, Miss Black was unable to risk proceeding to trial. Her lawyers eventually negotiated a guilty plea to a misdemeanor criminal count of feeding orcas. As a result of her guilty plea, she didn't have to serve jail, thankfully, but she had to pay a massive fine, endured a long period of time under criminal probation supervision, and she will forever carry the stigma and the collateral consequences of a criminal conviction. These stories aren't jokes. They're emotionally devastating, financially crippling nightmares for those who are unfairly charged under statutes or regulations that are written too broadly. Overcriminalization vests almost unchecked discretion in the hands of the executive branch. Federal prosecutors who operate it in an adversarial system where winning is often equated with achieving the most severe outcome for every person they accuse. And, you know, John mentioned that the head of Stalin's secret police said, show me the man, I'll show you the crime. It's maybe a little underknown fact that prosecutors in the Southern District of New York train their new young prosecutors with a game. They get famous people like Gandhi or Mother Teresa, and then they train their young prosecutors to try to think of what kind of federal crimes they could have pinned on those two. So it's not provocative to bring up that quote from Stalin's head of police, because that's how we're training these folks to enforce the laws against us. Another criticism I often hear when I raise concerns about overcriminalization is, as John mentioned, ignorance of the law is no excuse. But at this point, I don't know how your average law-abiding citizen determines what is criminal or not. I don't know every law, and I have been a criminal defense lawyer for many decades now. Several years ago, as part of a bipartisan congressional hearing on overcriminalization, it was revealed that our federal government stated itself that it could not count the number of federal criminal provisions in existence. When that's the case, I frankly don't understand how the average citizen is meant to keep up. And that doesn't even take into account that almost anything can be charged as a federal crime, given the overly broad and vague scope of many of our particularly more recently drafted federal laws. And all of this is to say nothing of the federal government's role in prosecuting local minor drug offenses, which I think is blatant federal overreach. Justice Scalia, hardly the soft on drugs liberal, once said it had been a great mistake to put routine minor drug offenses into the federal courts. Right now, nearly half of our federal prisons are incarcerated on drug charges. But it seems clear to me that the federal government's approach hasn't exactly done a great job of eradicating America's drug crisis. So when you have a criminal code that is so broad that it covers the conduct of us all, that it puts us in a situation where any of us could be prosecuted for something, it doesn't matter what political party you're from, and this has become an American problem. The cost of it is high. There are 1.25 million individuals in state or federal prison, and when local jails are included, that rises to roughly 1.8 million of us in jail. On a per capita basis, America's incarceration rate is among the highest in the world. The price tag for this system is steep. I don't have the most recent numbers. They haven't been published yet. But in 2023, the median annual cost to taxpayers was almost $61,000 per incarcerated person. although trust me when I say that that's a median price. So some states spend, you know, $20,000 per inmate, others above $200,000 per inmate. Are we really this nation of bad people? Are we a nation of criminals? I don't think so. I think what we are is a nation that has become addicted to the idea that criminal sanctions are the way we run our society. It's the only way to ensure compliance with every well-intentioned prescription. It's the primary way we respond to an accident or an unfortunate tragedy or a social ill. Thankfully, some of us on both sides of the aisle are finally beginning to see that we've gone too far and that it's going to take all of us from every political ideology to work ourselves back to a place of common sense and responsibility. In an age of bitter partisanship, there has been a surprising collaboration of groups from across the aisle who have worked together to address these issues. Groups who fundamentally disagree on all sorts of things, but who support returning the federal criminal law to its proper foundations. And there have been a number of pieces of legislation born of that collaboration. And two of those have been mentioned today, but I'm going to talk a little bit more about them. I'm going to focus my remarks on these pieces of legislation rather than the president's executive order out of respect for the time I have. But also, while I support the president's EO, the nature of EOs is fleeting. They just don't last. The next president can easily ignore it, unlike legislation, which once passed is much harder to change. And sadly, this EO might not even last the rest of the president's term, since, as I recall, during his first administration, President Trump issued an EO addressing overcriminalization, which I 1,000% supported. But for some reason, it was revoked or rescinded by the administration just a few months after it was issued. So for me, EOs are helpful. They can bring some immediate relief, and I am very much looking forward to seeing if this one does, but they are really a fleeting nature compared to legislation. So let me talk a little bit about those two pieces. The Count the Crimes Act would force various government actors to create a list of all criminal, statutory, and regulatory offenses in the federal law, list each of the elements, document the mens rea required, list the penalty, provide the number of prosecutions. All of this would eventually make it into a publicly accessible database. My organization supports this piece of legislation. I think it's a very important exercise to make federal prosecutors and the others who enforce federal criminal regulations to make an inventory of their own laws, how often they're using them. But ideally for me, we would recognize that this effort is just basically providing a base of information that this should then be put to good use. What would hopefully happen after such an index is created is that a highly qualified, diverse group of experts would sit down at a table together and go through them and determine what changes needed to be made. Which of these laws are unnecessary? Which are duplicative? Which lack appropriate mens rea, et cetera? Now, will that second step ever happen? And if it ever did, how many years would such an effort take? Great questions. But at least this bill represents a first step, so I support it. The second bill we're discussing today, the Mens Rea Reform Act, I feel is the fix we're all supporting because we know this careful assessment of each federal criminal provision isn't likely coming. So what this bill does is it picks a default mens rea provision for those criminal statutes and regulatory provisions that weren't well drafted. It picks the default mens rea of the term knowingly as the default. Now, that's not the highest level protection, but it is meaningful because, importantly, this bill provides a clear definition of what it means by knowingly, since that term means wildly different things in our current federal case law. And importantly, this default mens rea protection would apply to pretty much every element of the offense. Now, obviously, there are exceptions. First, the default wouldn't apply to subject matter or venue provisions. But also, if there is clear congressional intent from the way in which the criminal provision is drafted, then the mens rea term, the default, wouldn't apply to either a particular element, or if it's clear that it was Congress's intent to draft a strict liability criminal offense, then the default wouldn't apply. And lastly, the bill makes clear that this default shouldn't ever be interpreted to lower an existing mens rea that had been established by existing case law. Is this the very best fix for what I deem is a critically important problem? Frankly, no. The very best fix, in my mind at least, would be a thoughtful analysis of every federal criminal law provision in existence, all 300,000 plus of them, each provision carefully analyzed in light of the behavior it's attempting to deter, balanced with other public policy concerns, redrafted for clarity, for efficiency, for fairness. We actually need is an entire rewriting of our federal criminal code, because what we have now really shouldn't even be referred to as a code. I'm presuming many of the people on this call with us today are lawyers. Well, in law school, when it came to learning criminal law, most of us were actually taught something called the Model Penal Code. And that's been adopted, at least to some degree, in a number of states. But what we have at the federal level is not anywhere near as elegant or as organized as that. But it's what we should have. But in my mind, I just don't see that kind of massive overhaul of the federal criminal law, frankly, ever happening. And so until it does, rather this than the do nothing. I think we need solutions like the Mens Rea Reform Act to step in and try to act as a much needed band-aid. I am looking forward to taking any questions on either of these bills during the Q&A. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks. I really appreciated John and Shanna's comments. I agree with most of them. If there's time, I might come back to the Swiss cheese example and make a half-hearted defense of the Swiss cheese law. But I'd like to, given my background as a criminal law scholar, try to provide a bit of an overview and broader perspective on some of these issues. Mens rea is just a fancy Latin term, as I think Mark mentioned, for mental state, state of mind. And it doesn't have to mean intent. It could mean knowledge. It could mean recklessness. It could mean gross negligence. It could mean negligence. But I think we're all on this panel in agreement that there should be some level of mens rea for criminal law throughout the criminal law. And it's a very broad principle, this idea that there should be some level of mental state required. It could apply to white collar crimes. It could apply to drug and gun possession prosecutions. It could apply to rape and sexual assault prosecutions. The question there can arise. There's usually not much debate about whether there's an intent to engage in the sexual act or itself, but there can be arguments about whether a reasonable mistake was made about whether the other person consented to the sexual act. And on that issue, we need to address the question of mens rea. And I believe there, too, there should be some requirement of a minimum mens rea. Now, why should we care about this? Well, I think for many reasons, but the most compelling one, in my view, is based on a fundamental principle that no one should be criminally punished unless they morally deserve punishment. And here I'm referring to the notion of retribution, which is a somewhat fancy philosophical term for giving someone their just deserts. Retribution is one of the purposes of punishment. There are other important purposes: deterring crimes, incapacitating people who are dangerous. But I think in this particular context, retribution is the most important purpose to keep in mind. Giving someone their just deserts is a reason to punish, but if a person does not deserve any punishment, that should preclude punishment. And it should preclude punishment even if punishment would serve one of these other goals, such as deterrence or incapacitation. So you hear prosecutors say, well, we need to be able to have strict liability crimes to more effectively prosecute people. And that may well be true. It's hard to prove mens rea in some circumstances. Prosecutors would rather just focus on, was the harm caused? Did the person actually possess the gun or actually possess the drugs? So if all we cared about was deterring crime and locking up dangerous people, we might not care about mens rea, but we should care about mens rea. We should care about just deserts. There should be some kind of minimum mens rea across the board. Now, that still leaves a lot of questions about, and let me just mention two main ones at this point and maybe get into some of the others during Q&A. But first, what level of mens rea should be required? So the default mens rea statute suggests knowledge. That's a pretty high standard, and it may be more than we would actually want to require. Do we really want to say that a criminal defendant who recognizes that the sexual assault victim might not be consenting, but thinks, oh, what the heck, I'll go ahead. That person is merely reckless. And I think ordinarily recklessness should be enough, or perhaps even gross negligence should be enough. Ordinary negligence, the kind of negligence that's enough in tort for liability in tort law for a compensatory damage award, I think should not be enough. And just one simple example of that, imagine a surgeon is conducting surgery and her hand slips during the surgery and she accidentally cuts an artery and the person dies. Of course, she can be sued in tort law for negligence. Do we really want to say that that type of predictable carelessness should be enough for criminal liability? I certainly think not. We should reserve criminal law for seriously morally wrongful conduct. Now, a second question that arises is whether this principle of requiring mens rea or mental some minimum mens rea, is it just about factual questions? What about legal questions? And people often don't distinguish these two, but they're somewhat distinguishable issues. And the speakers today have distinguished them. They talked about ignorance of the law is no excuse. Here they're talking about, well, what should the rules be, the criminal law rules, as to a person's possible ignorance or reasonable mistake as to the criminal law? My own view is there should be a defense of reasonable mistake of law across the board, essentially closer to a negligence test in this context. I don't think it needs to be as stringent a mens rea requirement as the mens rea requirement for questions of fact. Let me just give you one example that sort of, I think, shows the difference between the mistake of fact or ignorance or mistake of fact issue and the mistake of law or ignorance or mistake of law issue. Think about the crime of having sex with an underage person. For good reason, we don't want people to be able to have a sexual contact or sexual intercourse with a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old. Okay, so there's an age of consent that varies a little bit in different jurisdictions. 16, 17, 18 are the options that states have chosen. So a person might know that the age of consent in their state is 18 and make a factual mistake in thinking the other person is 18 when they're actually only 16. That's a mistake of fact, and I would say that we should require at least recklessness or gross negligence as to that. But the defendant might also make a mistake about the law. They might think the age of consent is 16 in their state when it's actually 18. Should they get a defense if the other person is 16? Well, I think it depends. It depends on whether their mistake about what the law is reasonable. If the age of consent, for example, had been 16 for a very long time, it was just changed to 18, the change wasn't very well publicized, I'd say that's a good argument for saying a reasonable mistake of law defense should be recognized. The last thing I'll say, just in general terms, is giving a defense of reasonable mistake of law is one important way to address the serious problem of overcriminalization. There are many examples that John has given and others have given, and some of them seem kind of silly in terms of why are we criminalizing this. So let me just quickly go to the question of selling Swiss cheese which has no holes in it. In a way, that seems absurd. But when you think about who's selling Swiss cheese and what do people who buy Swiss cheese expect to get, do we really want to let sellers sell any form of cheese whatsoever, Colby or ricotta or who knows what, and call it Swiss cheese? I think there is a need to protect consumers. So in terms of the fair notice argument, I don't think it's terribly powerful in this particular context, but I do agree, do we really need to criminalize it? We can definitely have civil regulation here. We can fine a company that is misleading its consumers. That's a perfectly sensible way to address it. But retributive principles don't just address issues like mens rea. They also address questions, is the conduct itself sufficiently serious that the criminal law should address it as opposed to tort compensation or as opposed to civil fines and civil regulation? And I agree that it's a proper example of over-criminalization for those reasons. So...
So you don't actually disagree with anything either of us said.
A bad Yelp review or a better Business Bureau complaint about the cheese seller, I think we're in agreement that that would
might be more effective. Might be effective. Thanks.
Can I just comment on a few things, Mark? So I agree with, first of all, this is a great presentation by both my fellow panelists. I agree with a lot of what Shanna said. I think the Count the Crimes Act, that's really just a question of good housekeeping. I mean, the Emperor Caligula used to take laws and post them on the top of poles so he could say, well, they were available to the public, but nobody could read them. I mean, at least putting all of this in one place, and most criminals are not going to bother looking on that website, but anybody who wants to know what the law is and try to conform their conduct accordingly would at least have a place to go to. I think, though, the problem is that in this poisoned atmosphere, I'm not sure that either of those bills, political atmosphere, I mean, I'm not sure either of those bills is going to go anywhere, but that's a different thing. I'm not sure I agree. Shannon makes the point, it's correct from a factual standpoint, that we have per capita one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. You often hear people talking about mass incarceration. I just want to be on record that I'm not sure that I agree with that. I'm all in favor of incarcerating the right people for the right amount of time and no more. But it's unclear to me that we have an over-incarceration rate. I mean, we've got an awful lot of countries with a lot of very, very violent crime, and rule of law has completely broken down. The prisons are, to the extent they're filled with anybody, filled with the governing leaders' political enemies. But I think there are a lot of other countries that have dramatic under-incarceration problems. So I'm not sure where we all fall on that. And with respect to Ken's comment about mistake of law, my colleague Paul Larkin has written about this eloquently. He has suggested an affirmative defense in which somebody could present a mistake of law defense in which a jury would have to agree, one, that the defendant did not know that this violated the law, and two, that no reasonable person would have known that this was a violation of the criminal law, and that if that could be established to a jury's satisfaction, that would exonerate the person, they could be acquitted.
If I could just briefly respond to the mistake of law issue, some of you may know, New Jersey has a reasonable mistake of law defense. The language is, if the actor diligently pursues all means available to ascertain the meaning and application of the offense to his conduct, and honestly and in good faith concludes his conduct is not an offense, in circumstances in which a law-abiding and prudent person would also so conclude. So it fits what, you know, Paul Larkin has suggested and what John just mentioned. And I'm not aware that New Jersey had any major problems with people not obeying the criminal law because there's a reasonable mistake of law defense out there. So people often object to it, saying, well, it's going to result in huge numbers of prosecutions being dismissed. But that has not, I don't think, been the New Jersey experience.
Well, yeah, this has been terrific. I had two questions to throw it open, and then I'll hopefully bring in some from the audience. Number one, when Shanna was talking, reminded me of the issue of the process is the punishment. Even if you're ultimately exonerated, if you're indicted like Arthur Anderson, it caused them to go out of business, even though they were never convicted of anything or debarred from federal contracts. So if any of you want to comment on that. And then secondly, is there an idea that in certain kind of specialized circumstances where people willingly take on a role that requires certain levels of responsibility. So Sarbanes-Oxley, the CEO, has to certify the financial statements, which is kind of a duty of candor. You're supposed to disclose like materially negative things, so it's more than just not lying. But of course, it has criminal penalties, up to 20 years in prison, up to $5 million in fines. But there's the goal is to protect the investors who are, there's this asymmetry of information, right, between them and the CEO. Are we comfortable with a higher standard in that context? So I'll just throw those two out to the panel here.
Well, on that last point, Mark, something that you said sort of triggered in me that the UK has sort of a, it's not precisely mistake of law or fact defense, but it's this protective measure to step in when a white collar defendant in even a company is being prosecuted. And it's basically a compliance defense mechanism. And, they have to affirmatively put on that they have really great compliance measures, but it protects them from being prosecuted unfairly, basically, just because they have this, a higher standard. They're supposed to be watching out for folks. It is I can't be perfect at this job. And let me prove that I was really good at this job and I really put reasonable measures in place to try to get this job completely right. And I think something like that in the American law, whether it's just white collar, whether it's just for individuals, whether it's companies, we can argue those policy points later. But I do think that something like that could potentially be useful for us to consider, because the responsibility for our nation's CEOs and for companies writ large is just massive. You're talking about multinational level decisions, 24 hours a day. They can't possibly get everything right. And does every single slip up again mean, it's fair for them to be eligible to for criminal prosecution? Again, not talking about, holding them liable with shareholder suits or civil penalties, et cetera, but protection from criminal prosecution, which really does sort of end lives. I think, when they're trying to get it right is something that we ought to consider. And just going back to that first point that you mentioned, I mean, criminal prosecutions, even if you end up at the right end of it, really do end lives. They ruin families. I don't think I've ever publicly stated this on the record, but not a single one of my clients' marriages has ever survived a prosecution, even if things went the right way at the end of the day. These are devastating financially and emotionally, and they destroy families and they destroy lives. And they're sometimes necessary. We need to keep our society safe and operational, but we really should be exercising this sort of nuclear weapon very carefully, because it explodes in people's lives and it's devastating.
Let me say a couple of things. One, it's certainly true that for an unjust prosecution or one that's politically motivated, the process is the punishment, and that's a shame, and it should not be that way. But, look, Department of Justice and state prosecutors should not stop prosecuting people just because it's going to have a bad effect on the defendant or their families. As long as the person is guilty, that person brought all of that on him or herself. With respect to your example about, getting CEOs to sign off on things, I mean, at least you have there an instance, if it's a heavily regulated business, they will have fair warning about what their responsibilities are and what could subject them to criminal liability. That is not the same for small mom and pop businesses who may be subject exactly to the same regulations. I don't think it's fair to, if some lower echelon employee does something, either they take a bribe or whatever, and it doesn't come to light and the CEO has no way of knowing about it. I don't think it's fair just because the CEO signed some kind of a declaration saying everything's hunky-dory that all of a sudden they get criminally prosecuted. But I do think there needs to be, if you made a reasonable effort to inquire and find out whether or not your company is in compliance, you can be dealt with administratively. Perhaps the employee who did this should certainly be fired and possibly criminally prosecuted himself. But there, I think you do have to require a certain amount of discretion. Unfortunately, there are some prosecutors, and I've dealt with many of them. I was one myself, who I think are great. But there are some prosecutors where if you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And that that is so. And I think it requires a certain amount of judgment and discretion and that should ought to be properly exercised.
And Ted, did you want to comment? It seems like safe harbor provision is somewhere in there in terms of what Shannon was saying, for example.
Right. I'm just going to say in terms of corporations being prosecuted or corporate executives versus mom and pop or individuals, those are hugely different contexts in terms of mistake of law. Corporate executives have usually excellent legal advice available to research the law. So even in some of these kind of ridiculous examples, if you're getting into a particular activity, it's usually not that difficult to see what the criminal prohibitions are that might be affecting it. Not in all cases, but at least often. For individuals, I would be much more, if I were a judge, I would be much more inclined to give a case to the jury on reasonable mistake of law, because how can an ordinary person understand all of the not traditional criminal laws, but the malum prohibitum laws, the new kinds of regulations that are quite complex and might environmental regulations, other kinds of regulations that they might not expect.
Now, we have a question here on essentially the delegation doctrine and going back to a case, Hudson versus Goodwin from 1812, that said Congress can create federal crimes. And I think the question directed at you, John, and referenced the fact that Ed Meese liked the idea of really trying to revive. And I think there's some considerable support on the Supreme Court these days for reviving the delegation doctrine.
Well, look, the Supreme Court has only invalidated two pieces of legislation. They were both invalidated in 1935 on the non-delegation doctrine principle. The Supreme Court has come very, very close. Several of the justices have said, oh, gee, if the right case comes along, you know, we'll invoke the non-delegation doctrine. They came close in a criminal case involving the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act called Gundy. They haven't done it yet. They've now gone to other things like the major questions doctrine to kind of address those issues. I mean, yes, you ought to look at these regulations and see how closely connected they are to the actual implementing legislation and whether or not the regulation is off on a lark and tangent, creating a crime that isn't provided for in the implementing legislation or creating a mens rea standard that is not anywhere hinted at in the implementing regulation. And they ought to be challenged. They ought to be challenged as going above and beyond what the implementing legislation calls for. And you can certainly then invoke the non-delegation doctrine in those circumstances. Conservative litigators have been trying to get the court to find a non-delegation doctrine case that they really like and to invoke it. I'm all in favor of that, and perhaps a criminal case will come along that will give the justices that opportunity.
One of the problems is that we don't have enough of these criminal cases, these unfair prosecutions being brought up to the courts for review, though, because, you know, I'm not sure if the people who have joined this call understand that, you know, the world of TV prosecution, where people are charged with crimes and then they go to a jury trial or even a bench trial in front of a judge and they get their day in court and things are then decided. It just really isn't happening with the vast majority of prosecutions, either on the state level or the federal level. North of 95% of criminal cases in any jurisdiction are being handled by plea bargain. So, you know, and this is, of course, one of the things that I think is a massive problem in our country. And so these prosecutions aren't really being challenged in a way that they should, because it's very difficult. And you run the risk if you go to trial, and then you often are punished with, you know, a prison sentence that would be three times longer than what was being offered to you. So a lot of people will just try to engage with the prosecutor in a compromised sort of negotiation for, well, I'll do this amount of time instead of possibly risk this amount of time. And then these unfair prosecutions aren't really getting in front of courts so that courts say, hey, wait, that was a complete overreach. That's not what the statute meant. This agency shouldn't ever have even had criminal jurisdiction over this person. So that's not helping us get these cases in front of the Supreme Court for them to really see what's going on.
Yeah, well, on the subject of the fact that very few cases go to trial, we do have an interesting question, which kind of deals with jury nullification, or at least the idea of the jury finding the person not guilty, notwithstanding the evidence. And I do wonder, I mean, theoretically, it could affect the plea negotiations in terms of giving the defendant more leverage. But I think, you know, there's a question, perhaps given what you said, Shanna, of to what degree this would make an impact. And then obviously the question of whether people would, you know, potentially get off for serious crimes, who, you know, potentially could be a danger and all of that. But there is some disagreement, I guess, historically on what the role of juries are in this context. Does anyone want to address that?
Look, jury nullification is a fact of life. I mean, the real controversy is, I think, whether or not lawyers can get up there and say, pay no attention to that guy wearing the robe. This is an unjust thing and you should acquit him regardless of what the facts are or how you're instructed the law. I mean, you're going to go to some jurisdictions where you might get a marijuana prosecution or whatever, and they like their stoners and they decide they're going to acquit the person. You just had a guy who got acquitted for a misdemeanor offense, a Department of Justice employee to boot, for throwing a sandwich at an ICE officer, you know, whether that was assault. I mean, I think that jury nullification has a long history. It is a reality. The bigger argument about is whether it's proper to argue to a jury that that is what they ought to be doing. But whether you argue it or not, it does happen once in a while.
And actually, I was just about to raise the sandwich man case, which I'll be teaching in my class later today. But I think it's a good example of the helpful aspect of jury nullification, as juries being able to exercise their moral sense of whether something is really worth prosecuting. It does seem like a case of nullification. I've looked at the just my standard jury instructions for that crime. And yes, he was knowingly causing a contact with a federal officer or a police officer without any consent, but seemed to be politically motivated. It seemed to be the kind of thing, it's an extremely unlikely they would have brought a serious, initially a felony charge, if it weren't for the actual context. So I think jury nullification can play an important role, but, you know, Shanna is absolutely right. There's so many of these cases are plea bargained, and the ones that aren't, there's a potential penalty of being subjected to a much more serious criminal punishment. So it's really unfortunate that we have the system that we do, where so few cases go to trial.
Now, we have another question about sunset provisions. So criminal laws automatically sunset and have to be renewed, force us to rethink whether we need them. And Minnesota several years ago had an unsession, which was just dedicated to repealing laws, not specific to criminal laws, but I think some of those were repealed as well. But does anyone want to comment on those kind of related ideas?
Yes, bring them on. I volunteer to sit on the commission to look at the federal law and undo a bunch of them and sunset many of them. And look, if we needed them that badly, we can pass them again. Sure, I'm 100% in support of that. Do I ever think it will happen as a person who has 20 years of federal lobbyist experience in this area? No. I do think what is possible is potentially, you know, there have been some bills every once in a while that took sort of 20 or 30 of these silly ones, misusing Smokey the Bear's image, the Swiss cheese example, that kind of thing. They're, you know, could one of those pass as part of, you know, a larger criminal justice package? Maybe, but I don't think it's going to happen in a meaningful way on the federal criminal level for a number of reasons, including practicality. I mean, when you are talking about 300,000 plus laws, it's a lot different than perhaps, you know, a state legislature sitting down and really sort of doing it thoughtfully as it should be done.
I'm all in favor of a commission to study the laws and to recommend to Congress that they repeal certain laws. I'm not so sure I would be in favor of something that says every criminal law has a sunset provision. There are only so many legislative days that, you know, in any given year, Congress, although it often doesn't do much, has an awful lot it needs to be doing. And I'm not sure it's worth taking up very precious legislative time, which it would require to reenact laws. I would be in favor of requiring that when you consider passing a criminal law, that you consider a sunset provision. I would be in favor of, as part of a review, perhaps recommending to Congress that there are certain laws that, if they're not going to be outright repealed, perhaps ought to be evaluated in the near future to see whether they've outlived their usefulness and ought to be sunset. I'm not sure I would be in favor of something that says all criminal laws sunset after 7 years unless they're reenacted by Congress.
No, and let me be clear, I don't either. But this sunsetting idea has been raised in the federal regulatory provision context. And there, I think it makes a little bit more sense, maybe even couple it with sort of a DOGE-like approach where you say to the agencies, you get to designate your top five, really, or top 10 or whatever, it doesn't matter, you know, really meaningful federal criminal regulatory provisions that you need to keep Americans safe. And then the rest of them will be sunsetting in 7 years, unless, and of course, I'm an exception queen, unless you come to us and really make the case about why public safety would be at risk if you didn't do that. I mean, something like that, I'm all for.
One thing I might add about this is often in my criminal law classes, I ask my students to look through the criminal codes of California, where I now teach, or Massachusetts, where I used to teach, and, you know, tell me if you find anything you find problematic. And Massachusetts has a lot of laws to the effect of swearing, using the Lord's name in vain is a criminal offense. There's a lot of things on the books that there's no political capital in repealing. So they just stay there. Now, I'm not sure it's a huge problem because prosecutors don't usually invoke them, but it would be nice to clean it all up. And, I do agree that the best solution is comprehensive criminal code reform. Not likely to happen soon, but at some point, maybe the coalitions of people on the left and one who are more conservative will come together and say, we need to rationalize the federal criminal code.
Well, I really want to thank everyone for this lively discussion. And I think that hopefully this will help put the overcriminalization issue back on the front burner in Washington and begin to address some of these issues. And hopefully we'll find out what is occurring as a result of the executive order and see a chance for these bills to see the light of day. I really want to thank John, Shanna, and Ken, and I'll turn it back over to the Federal Society official account here. Thanks so much.
So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you, our experts, for the benefit of your time and expertise today. And I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on your emails and our website for announcements about upcoming virtual events. So thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.